Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report, a special Thanksgiving weekend edition. I hope all of our U.S. listeners are having a very great long weekend and enjoyed a great meal and some time off on Thursday, even stretching throughout into the weekend. We're happy to report that we do have a full show recorded for you, and we also recorded number of daily editorials and company updates throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and our podcast, The KE Report. On this weekend's show, we're going to start off talking about resource stocks, more the metal stocks, and then in the back half of the show, switch over to the energy sector. We're starting off the show with Adrian Day, founder of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Now, Adrian, as I said, I want to stick to the stocks, and I want to start off with the precious metals stocks, the higher end of them, the majors, because we have gotten through earnings season. I want your take on how the majors are doing from an earnings perspective. What stood out to you? What surprised you? Please break down some of the majors, their earnings.
Yeah, as always with the larger companies, it's always a bit of a mixed bag. You know, if a company has a dozen mines around the world, there's always going to be some that have upside surprises and some that have downside surprises. That is not surprising that there were some good and some bad. I would say, generally speaking, that at most companies, operations are doing reasonably well. Cost increases are beginning to moderate a little bit. What was perhaps a bit surprising is that probably most of the companies, are still going to be right at the lower end of their earnings estimates for the year, their earnings, their guidance for the year, or even miss it for the year. So Barrick is going to miss, in all likelihood, and costs for Barrick are going to be above their guidance. Royal Gold is going to be right at the low end or perhaps miss. And I think that goes to the over optimism that we had at the end of last year, beginning of this year, when these annual guidances were set. And again, there's always something that goes wrong. And we can look at Royal Gold. They had more than 2 weeks. Sorry, it was more like 2 months suspension of mining at Peñasquito, which is one of their larger royalties, not their largest, but one of their larger royalties. Well, obviously, that affects your earnings significantly. It also affected Wheaton, which also has a stream on Peñasquito. Royal also has a fairly significant royalty on Pueblo Viejo in Dominican Republic, which is Barrick's mine, or Barrick and Newmont's mine. And the ramp up to the expansion of Pueblo Viejo is going much, much slower than expected. And whereas they were expecting it to be sort of up to speed by the third quarter, it now looks like it's not going to be until the middle of next year. And so that hurt them. And then also Centaurus at Mount Milligan, which is their largest royalty slash stream, they also came out with reduced production guidance. So again, for a company like Royal, which is a royalty streaming company, all of these operational issues are outside of their control. But it just shows, I guess it goes to show that when they're setting guidance at the beginning of the year, you're not thinking you're going to have a suspension at one of your mines. You're thinking that the ramp up is going to go as planned and expected by the operator, Barrick, and so on. And so, you know, it hurts the earnings. But yeah, so those are a couple of things that did hit me. But I think it's also worth noting that there are, you know, multiple companies that seem to have turned the corner on operations. And one I'd point to would be Fortuna, which is not obviously one of the largest, but, you know, if you go down a step to the intermediate, you know, they've had 2 or 3 years now of just of let's say bad things happening. The market didn't like it when they expanded from Latin America to West Africa and punished them for that. A lot of people didn't like it when they expanded from silver into gold, although they already were producing a lot of gold. Let's not forget that. But that hurt them. They had a bunch of misses, frankly, on their quarterly reports. And they also had that horrible fiasco in Mexico with the San Jose mine, where the environmental agency, we don't need to rehash that, but people who know it will know what I'm talking about. And people who don't, just take it that it was an 18-month fiasco where the environmental agency tried to cancel their long-term mining permit, in effect. What we've seen with Fortuna in the last 3 quarters, really, is increasingly they're, you know, hitting their stride. The production and the earnings and the costs are where they said they would be. And this last quarter for Fortuna was really quite a stunning quarter, led by the first quarter at Séguéla, which is the new mine in Ivory Coast, with very, very low costs. I think their costs for the quarter were under 600, and that brings down the costs across the whole company. The federal court in Mexico has upheld their 12-year mining permit, which is what the permits in Mexico are, the longest they would be. You know, they just renewed, and they renewed for 12 more years. And so we have good operations, good production, and very low costs. So that's a company, in my mind, that is perhaps set for a re-rating. But I think, you know, the thing to remember is that anytime you have a large mining company, you're always going to have some, if not every quarter, but you're always at risk of having one or two major things go wrong at one or two of your operations. And I think the market this year was not really prepared for that.
Yeah, Adrian, there's no shortage of problems that can befall the mining industry. But to the point you made about a lot of the intermediates and mid-tiers turning their ship around and things starting to improve and inflation starting to moderate, there's still pretty healthy margins. And the majors have been tied up with each other, really acquiring one another for the last couple of years. And a lot of people keep asking us about M&A. When are we going to see more M&A in the sector? We have seen a little bit of that. A couple of the mid-tiers like B2 Gold going down and grabbing Sabina, or more recently Calibre grabbing Marathon Gold. Do you think we'll continue to see that trend out of the intermediate producers where they have improved their operations, they do still have good margins at these prices, and maybe they'll go on the hunt for some of the junior development companies or single asset producers?
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of that. And what we haven't seen much of is the seniors buy the intermediates at big premiums. We haven't seen that. But I do think we're going to see more of the better quality, more well-financed intermediates like B2 and Fortuna, frankly. I mean, again, both of those two companies have had some acquisitions in the last couple of years. But both of those are in a strong enough position where they could take on something else. I think we're going to see more of that, frankly. I never really buy something because I think it's going to get taken over, because you just never really know, because there's so many factors that go into it. You know, a company could be ripe for being taken over, but the obvious candidates for buying them just have other things on their plate at the time. And so these mergers and acquisitions don't always happen when we think they should. They often take a lot longer to happen. But yeah, there's no question in my mind that we're going to see more of the intermediates get together to build larger companies, and the intermediates buying the single asset developers and even producers. I think we're going to see more of that.
Now, do you think it matters if it is a developer or a producer? Because it seems like right now, if you have a mine that's up and running, that carries a lot more weight than these developers that still need to build these mines because of higher costs that have come in.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, because a lot, you know, depends. There's two ways of looking at it. This, if a project has just got a feasibility study, I think most larger companies would prefer to buy that before they start doing the financing and doing the construction. Because Company A, that is, let's say Company A, that's a larger company, they want to decide where the financing comes from. They want to decide if there's any hedging or any forward sales that go along with that. They want to decide if there's a stream on the asset. And they might want to decide, albeit there's a feasibility study, but they don't want the construction to start and go too far down the line, which locks them into a particular mining scheme. And so I think if you've got an asset that has not yet started to be constructed or the financing isn't there yet, a company would prefer, and you saw that with B2, a company would rather go in and grab it before a lot of that stuff is set in stone. You know, if you're in a more, let's say a more risky, I think most companies certainly want the junior to have the permits in place. Because in many jurisdictions, you know, it's a lot easier if you're looking at, you know, whatever, call it Ajax if you want. But if Ajax has been working in the remote part of Peru for the last 10 years and built a good relationship with locals, you want that smaller company with the good relationship to go ahead and get the permits before, you know, the big beast from the United States or Canada comes down, which means they have to start the whole process of community relations again. So, yeah, I think you definitely want to get the permits, but I think most of the companies would rather not have the financing already underway. Because, again, as I mentioned, you know, a company A may decide, you know, in their financing package, they'll issue X amount of shares, but they'll put a stream on it, and a larger company may not want the stream. So they want to get in before that happens.
Well, Adrian, just speaking of the streams, we were at several conventions and conferences this year where the development stage companies or even big producers that want to build a development project are in a bit of a pickle to raise capital. You know, sometimes the capital markets are more expensive now because of higher rates. They don't want to dilute shareholders down with equity raises. And so they're looking at the royalty and streaming portion of the business to fund part of the CapEx build. And especially when you dive down into the development companies, they're so undervalued right now and their cost of capital is not nearly as attractive. They've got to raise huge amounts of money to get a mine built. What is your position on them putting a stream or royalty on the project? Does that dissuade the majors or the larger companies from buying them eventually? Is it a good solution? Is it good for the royalty companies right now to be going after that part of the business? What's your take on that discussion?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, look, first of all, if you're a development company, if you're a company with a project and you want to build that project, there's a lot of people out there, and we know who they are, but there's a lot of people in the industry who say royalties and streams are bad for the business and I'm never going to do that. But the truth is, if you've got an asset that you want to build, you have to dilute it some way or the other. You either bring in a partner, which means you dilute to the asset level, you borrow money, which has to be repaid, which is part of the cash flow from the mine goes to repay your loan. And the loans always come with some sort of terms and conditions. You have to issue equity or you issue a stream or royalty, but you have to dilute in some way or another. And as you alluded to there, it's really a matter of looking at the market at any given point and saying, where can I get the most money to build my mine for the least dilution? And right now, you've got very, very low stock prices, as you said. So issuing equity is very expensive. You've got high interest rates. And a lot of U.S. banks are not lending to mining. Some of the Canadian banks still are, and some of the European development banks still are. But, you know, it can be difficult for a larger mine to get significant debt financing without onerous covenants on the debt, which you don't want. And so sometimes right now, streaming can in fact be the most favorable form of financing. It varies with the market, but I don't think one can be a purist, if you like, and adamant and say, you know, I don't want to do a royalty or stream because that gives too much away from my future mine cash flow. Because you're always going to have to dilute. So right now, given the market we just talked about, you know, streams become much more attractive to a development company. Because royalty streaming companies, you know, as we know, they go through phases, you know, looking for different areas where they can come in and provide something to the company at a good opportunity. So, you know, 10 years ago, of course, we had the big blow-ups and the big diversified base metal companies. And so the royalty companies were able to come and write large checks for balance sheet repair and get significant byproduct royalties or streams that would last a long period of time. Well, that period has gone. And for the last several years, companies were sort of, you know, in 2016, 17, 18, companies were saying, well, where can we now find attractive opportunities? And right now, the attractive opportunities are with largely single asset developers who need money to build their mine, can't get it from the banks or can't get sufficient from the banks, don't want to raise the equity, and don't particularly want to bring a partner in. And so the streams are an ideal financing in this environment, which is good for both parties, in my view.
It is, but it is also sometimes handcuffing to some of these companies that, you know, quite frankly, just don't have a whole lot of financing options right now. The royalty and streaming companies, they are liking this environment because they do have money. Let's shift our focus a little bit more to another sector that we touched on the last time we had you back on the show, and that's critical minerals. Can you share with us your approach when investing or even looking at investing in any critical minerals or the companies?
Sure. I mean, if we're including things, you know, the big metals like copper in critical metals, you know, I think copper would be after gold and silver would be my number one favorite. And we see increasingly in the news in the last 6 months how the copper supply is challenging. And it's not just challenging 5 years out. It's becoming challenging right now. We saw that with Codelco in their recent report. The CEO left after less than a year. And he pointed out the difficulty of building large copper mines in his country, in Chile, and likely ongoing reduction in production from Chile. Again, you know, he was the CEO of Codelco, so he was focused on Chile. But we're seeing that in a lot of countries. So to me, copper is very, very, very compelling, and the valuations of the stocks, notwithstanding the little bounces we've had recently, but the valuations of the companies are very, very compelling. In copper, I'm really looking at two main areas. One would be, you know, the very largest and the best. So, I mean, if an ordinary investor wants exposure to copper and doesn't want to be, you know, looking at exploration companies, dealing with the risk in exploration and looking at the companies day in, day out, you know, it's difficult to go wrong with Freeport, which is the largest of the publicly traded copper companies. But we're going to see more consolidation among the larger and second tier copper companies. We've seen Teck agree to sell their coal business so they can focus more on the copper, become a more pure copper company. And I think whether you're looking at Antofagasta or Teck or First Quantum, I think we're going to see some M&A in that sector for sure. And of course, the reason Newmont bought Newcrest, it wasn't for their gold mine in Papua New Guinea, it was for their copper primarily. When we go down the list of a sort of smaller critical minerals and what used to be called strategic metals and rare earths and all that kind of stuff, I must say, just this is the way I do it. It's the way I feel comfortable doing it. I prefer not to sort of jump on these bandwagons, which have been very, very successful for a lot of people. Don't misunderstand me. But I prefer to get exposure to the smaller metals and more specialized minerals through other companies that I like anyway. So as an example, Midland Exploration, which is exploring for gold and copper in Quebec, they also have a big push on with two joint ventures looking for lithium. One is with Rio Tinto. If they are successful, that will be a meaningful boost to Midland. If they are unsuccessful, it doesn't destroy the company because it's not a pure lithium play. And so whether it's Midland or whether it's Kenneland, which also has some lithium, whether it's Altius, which was a large shareholder, still is a large shareholder in Lithium One that they spun off, and they retain some shares and some royalties. I'm getting exposure by investing in those companies. You're getting exposure, meaningful exposure to the smaller metals, but without it, without the risk of the pure plays.
Are you picking up on the trend that a lot of the interest in critical minerals is coming from investors not traditionally in gold and silver stocks or the precious metals, maybe not even interested in copper, but they're coming in through the doorway of lithium and EVs or rare earths or graphite, you know, manganese, some of these smaller metals, as you say, more niche metals. But you are seeing the governments of the world put money into these projects, especially nickel and lithium and rare earths. You are seeing manufacturers like battery companies, automakers coming down and partnering directly with lithium companies, nickel companies. Do you think that's a new dynamic the resource space hasn't seen before? And what do you make of that groundswell starting in the critical minerals from the government and manufacturing side?
Oh, it's absolutely a new thing, because gold mining companies traditionally have sort of been their own little sector. And, you know, governments have not, certainly for 50 years, governments have not been at all interested in the gold mining sector. And certainly large traditionalists, whether they're investors or whether they're, you know, companies, as you mentioned, have had no reason particularly to look at the gold mining sector. But now you're seeing interesting developments, as you mentioned some of them. But I mean, one interesting development that may go nowhere, but one of the large U.S. car manufacturers approached Agnico, and this is public, approached Agnico to see if Agnico wanted to sort of be their arm for looking for lithium in Canada. And a car manufacturer was willing to put up 100% of the costs of that in return for the supply. And Agnico would get, you know, their proportionate compensation. And what's interesting is Agnico has no expertise in lithium. Agnico has no history in lithium. And yet, you know, one of the car manufacturers, and we don't know which one it was, at least I don't, it hasn't been publicly announced, looked at Agnico and saw this is a very successful gold mining company that knows Quebec and Ontario and Nunavut. They know the area. They're good. They're quality. Hey, let's joint venture with these people. So I find that very, very interesting. And again, you know, Rio is jumping all over smaller companies in Canada looking for lithium. So yeah, we're going to see more of that, no question, no question. And how much of this will develop into actually producing money-making mines, that's another question. You know, I don't want to be the cynic, but, you know, I've been around a little longer than you two, probably longer than you two put together. You know, I remember we've been through these booms in the past. You know, there was a nickel boom in Australia in the 70s, and there was the rare earths boom in the 80s, and there was the strategic metals boom in the 90s. And each one of these, you know, rode very, very strong and collapsed at the end. And, you know, sometimes there wasn't an awful lot of actual production to show for it. I'm not saying that's going to happen now, because obviously the electrification is a very, of both the power grid and automobiles, is a trend that's going to stick around for a meaningful period of time. But that doesn't mean that everyone looking for lithium is going to find lithium. And more importantly, what they find isn't necessarily going to become a profitable mine. I'm also concerned, frankly, with some of the niche metals, and this is a longer term concern, but of substitution. You know, I don't think copper's going to be substituted for anytime soon. But, you know, as you know, people are working on batteries of various types that don't need lithium. And so substitution is always an issue. And it's not so much for cost, because as you know, when you have a critical element in a battery or in a uranium in a power plant, the cost is almost insignificant. You know, you need that critical element. The company's going to pay whatever is required. But there'll always be substitution when people work on not so much, you know, cheaper versions, but on better versions, on versions that have that don't require metals or minerals that are in short supply. And so, you know, that's always something that's going to happen. And it may take 10 years or 20 years, but we're going to see that happen, no question. I mean, just as 50 years ago, we didn't have lithium batteries. And so these things do change and develop over time.
All right, Adrian, thank you very much for your time. Diving a little bit more into the stocks, I always enjoy reading over your work and following up with you, getting your thoughts on these markets, also diving into the critical minerals. Adrian, thank you again for your time this weekend. I hope you have a great long weekend. I'm sure we'll chat again next month. Everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back, shifting our focus to the energy sector.
Thank you so much.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.